Can you say your name and spell it, please?
Okay, my name is Gary Stevens, with one R in Gary, G-A-R-Y, and Stevens with a V, S-T-E-V-E-N-S.
And what year was you born?
And I was born in 1953, the 8th of December.
And what year did you move into the Leytonstone area?
Well, I was a student at Goldsmiths, and I think I probably moved in there from Hackney. I was living in Hackney with some ex-students from Goldsmiths, and I think probably about sort of 82 is when I moved into 281 Grove Green Road with Minna Thornton at the time. We were a couple then, and it was the first kind of proper house I had. Everything else had been rather kind of, you know, a kind of student model.
Mm.
And this actually looked, kind of did resemble a kind of ordinary house. We sort of played house for it.
Mm. And when did you actually move out of the area completely?
Well, I did a sort of a hop. We broke up in about sort of 89. We got married, and the marriage went bung almost immediately. And then I went to Iceland for a couple of months, and then lived on Julian Maynard Smith's floor for a couple of months in Wandsworth, and then moved back to Philibrook Road. Sonia Boyce had just moved out. I was working with Cornelia Parker, and she was living in the flat at the top of 161 Philibrook Road, and Sonia moved out of the basement, so she suggested that I move in, which was very convenient for me, and that's what I did. So I had two addresses on that kind of main drag where the M11 was. But then after that, I moved out of there and lived in 1A Moyers Road, which was just around the corner a bit. Actually, it's just slightly out of the area, not in line of the M11.
Oh, was that an Acme house as well?
No, that was a little flat that I bought. And I just about managed to buy it. I had no money, really. And we were all moving out of these kind of short life housing. And we'd all lived in short life housing. And I couldn't really afford to buy anything. And the market was going up and up and up. And I do remember going out thinking I needed a car and I needed a house, and I looked in a estate agent's window, and it was impossible. I couldn't possibly buy, even think about buying. I couldn't really pay proper rents, and I couldn't really afford a car either. And I remember sort of coming away with a sort of pair of good boots and a Swiss Army knife. I think that was you know, I thought probably I'd have to become some kind of nomad. It was only because I think I either got some money. It was the Paul Hamlin Award. I think I got a Paul Hamlin Award, and that gave me a lump sum of money, which I could just use on a kind of small deposit on a flat. And so that's how I managed that move. But that was about 95 eventually. So I was in Grove Green Road probably between sort of 82 and 87. And then with a bit of a gap, 87, 88 to 95 in Philibrook Road, and then 2 years in Moyers Road.
Oh,
and I left out. I left the area for Manor House, where I am now, in about 97.
So, when you applied to Acme, did you send slides and go for an interview?
No, I don't remember doing all that at all.
What do you remember?
I don't remember anything about it, actually. I don't remember anything about the process. I remember applying for it and being on a list, but I don't ever remember sending in slides. Certainly didn't attend an interview. I can't remember, actually, what the process was. I think they just either knew of me or had some way of knowing that you were an artist or was endorsed by someone. I don't know.
Right.
I can't remember.
So when you first lived there, you was at the Slade, weren't you, doing your MA?
That was sort of 81 to 83 I was there.
Oh, right. So did you, when you moved to the area, it was 82? did you say?
Yeah, so it...
Last year?
Yeah, when I first moved into Grove Green Road, it was you know, coming towards the end of that.
Do you remember Acme offering you the house and you going to see it for the first time? Like the first house you lived in?
No, I just jumped at it, really. You know, I'd always done short life things. I was just kind of grateful that anything kind of showed up, really. And if you didn't have a leaky roof, I was happy. You know, there was not much of a kind of, oh, I don't like the colour of that one, or, you know, I don't like the look of it. I mean, it's quite funny that now I ended up sort of buying a place with Minna. We got back together again. And I'm very happy about that. And now, you know, one's kind of fussy. I ended up buying, really, because it was far cheaper than renting. And we could do, you know, we had the deposit to do it. So it made sense, really, in the end.
Mm.
Although I did quite like the community of people living there. You know, it made working possible then. Because there really wasn't, no one was actually earning money, really, doing what they were doing. So the only thing that made it really possible was that your kind of standard of living was, you know, it didn't cost you very much to actually live, unlike now.
Yeah. So can you describe, say, the first house that you lived in, what it looked like from memory?
Well, it was a terrace house that actually really, pretty similar to the one I'm in now. It sort of must have been sort of 1930s sort of terrace house, kind of a blue front door, hallway, small living room, bay window, and then there was a kind of, you know, tiny kitchen with a sort of plastics lean-to that sort of blew away in the storm. I think it was, what was it, about 1987 or something like that.
That Hurricane
Henry, or that was something. There was a hurricane, and anyway, we lost our lean-to roof there. And he had a small garden, and it was just a very nice little place. And it does bear a resemblance to the place we're in now. So I suppose that's partly because Minna has a sort of part Danish connection, so everything has a sort of slightly sort of Scandinavian feeling to it.
Yeah,
you know, independently of the sort of IKEA furniture, but it does have that feeling.
So, like, when you first moved in, did you sort of come with a lot of furniture and stuff, or did you kind of build up?
No, I had virtually nothing, actually, but Minna had inherited something, or had, you know, had some pieces of furniture. Her father was Peter Thornton. He was kind of he was at the V&A, and you know, he was a director of the Soane Museum. So he had, you know, lots of quite nice bits and pieces. So Minna had some nice furniture, and I furnished most of my houses with the props for shows. You know, I would go down Brick Lane, boot sales and auctions, and buy this furniture for stage shows, chairs and tables, and that kind of stuff. And then I didn't have any storage space, and I needed a table, so it doubled as my furniture. Or it worked the other way around, that I needed plates in a performance, and so I used all my own plates to smash, and then I didn't have any plates. So generally, the furniture was interchangeable with the props in the shows.
Yeah. So did you kind of, like, have your house set up? Like, where did you have your studio, or did you not need a studio?
The first things I did in Grove Green Road, actually, kind of the first things I set up doing, I would rehearse in the house. They were small scale things, two hander things, so I could do that. But when I started to get a bit bigger, I did. The first show I did was called Invisible Work, and it was about sort of 84. And then the next one was, and that was with Julian Maynard Smith, and the next one was If the Cat Fits, and with Caroline Wilkinson. And that was sort of 86, and went on from there. but you know, but it was mainly made at home. But the next one was about six people and was quite an elaborate thing. And that was working with Cornelia Parker as on the collection of objects, because I hated shopping and markets and things really, and she loved it. So it was great. It was great going with her. I needed. We got a disused Woolworths on the old Kent Road. But I've always been based with arts admin, who kind of moved around. But they're now in Aldgate East. So they've always administered me. And of late they've got rehearsal spaces, so I tend to use those rehearsal spaces now. But at that time, I would apply for an Arts Council grant, and in that grant would be the cost of hiring a space. And at that time, there were lots of derelict places.
Mm.
You know, they're all about to be developed and converted and sold on. But at that time, so many exhibitions and residential places were available to artists, really. Loads of shows I saw, loads of rehearsal spaces, all in disused, derelict buildings.
Mm. So, you described partly the Grove Green House. What was the other house like in Philibrook Road?
Yes, that was big. That was larger scale. It had a tile path going to the front door, big hallway, and it was a dilapidated but grand house, and it was divided. The stairs were blocked off, so after you went through the front door of the house, there was another door that led up to Connie's top floor flat. And the stairs were boarded in, so it was self-contained.
Okay.
And I had the whole front room, which had a kind of hoop skirt that was part of the If the Cat Fits costume hanging on the wall, and various bits of peeling wallpaper. I didn't have a bed; I just had a mattress in one corner. And it was a bit like camping, actually, in there, to be honest. And then there was a large... I went down the corridor, which was by the side of the stairs, into... And there was a small bathroom on the right, and then at the back. In the back was a black painted kitchen, which was. And then there was a kind of a lean-to and a quite kind of big garden out the back. And it was quite good because you could sort of hose this place down. So it was used quite a lot for parties. This, my place was used for parties. Connie and John Smith had birthdays fairly close to one another. So they used to have a joint birthday. And because it was my flat, I joined in. I called it mine, and we split it. But it was never my... all the people that came into my kitchen didn't know who the hell I was. They all knew Connie and Jeff. So there was a great hoo-ha about their birthday. I always ignored mine, but that was quite. But it was fantastic for that because you could just clear it out completely. One year there was a sort of disasters theme or something like that. Because I had I'd done a show called Animal with lots of small soft toys, and I just had them in bin liners out the back in this shed.
Yeah.
And we just kind of filled cabinets with them, so there was all these kind of squashed animals sort of trapped in these cabinets hanging from the light fittings. That's all.
And why was it painted black, do you know?
Well, I think Sonia Boyce did that, and but I think kind of Connie's had painted hers grey, I think, but it was a way of dealing with floorboards, so all the floorboards were just painted because they were fairly kind of rough. So rather than sanding them down and sort of varnishing them, everything was just painted back. No one really had carpets.
Oh, okay, you were talking about the floors. I thought you meant the walls.
No, the floors on the whole were just whitewashed over wallpaper. So there was wallpaper under there, but then they'd just been painted white.
Which house did you prefer?
Well, there was. Well, there's. I, I, I can't answer that question because they were, it was like a, I, there was two kind of quite distinct lives, really. You know, I was reasonably happy most of the time with Minna, and then we split up, and then so it was unhappy at the end there. And then I was kind of pleased to move in to 161 Philibrook, and that was exciting. You know, it was kind of being there with Connie and doing, you know, dizzying about there. But I was pretty miserable because I was on my own and sitting there. So that was more like camping. But it was so it was less of a kind of commitment to it as a kind of place to live. Although, you know, I wasn't planning to go anywhere else at the time. I didn't really care actually too much about it. I was busy working and I cared about work and I poured all my energy into that and not so much into the place I was.
So do you think it was more like a studio with a bed in it?
It was a bit, yes. Mm. Yeah, I would have a kind of typewriter and a, you know, sort of small chair and a table, and it was all very Spartan. And that's how it was, really.
Mm. And what about the street Philibrook Road then, when you was down there? Because can you remind me again that period that you was in Philibrook Road? Was it the latter?
Yes. I mean, it was a mixture. It was interesting because it was a kind of, there was a large arts community. So there was two pubs, the Northcote and the Heathcote, I think it was. And the Northcote was actually taken over more or less by the arts community. And the Heathcote was more the kind of local people. And on the whole, I enjoyed both, really. And kind of got away with going into both, but it was a kind of split community. You know, everyone kept to themselves, really, kept their heads down, it seemed that the road was divided. One side of the road was due for demolition, so all the artists lived on one side of the road, and then Philibrook Road. And on the other side of the road, it wasn't. So they were all the kind of the people that had lived there for a long time then. So it was a kind of peculiarly sort of split community. But it was absolutely mad, actually, when it was in sort of 95, when it was going. Because of the sort of tribes, you know, all the artists that thought they were kind of, you know, interesting, became the most boring group of people living in the area, because there was people living in the trees, which, you know, they were definitely wilder. You know, like, I remember going to Goldsmiths, you know, work at Goldsmiths with my bag, you know, and it felt like I was, and if anybody started up a chainsaw to cut down a tree, you know, the trees would come alive with these people, you know, heading towards the noise. And then there was a sort of labouring, sort of hard hat people who were slowly demolishing, systematically demolishing the place. But they would have to go into a house. There would be an exchange of keys. They'd go into the house, smash all the plumbing, smash the kind of facilities in the place, and then brick up the front doors and windows. And then they would put a guard on the door until the cement dried. Because if they didn't do that, you know, people would just take the walls down and then kind of occupy it. But someone somewhere had the brilliant idea of sort of employing this group of guards who they were all black, and they were in there, and they would sort of have bonfires in the baths, and they didn't know what the hell was going on. And so the kind of people in the trees didn't feel so aggressive towards them. You know, if they'd all been sort of white blacks, they would have felt very happy to abuse them, but it was a kind of interesting way of diffusing that. But it was mad. So there would be an exchange of keys, and then there would normally be this sort of sound of someone digging their way through the adjoining wall or something. When I finally left 161 Philibrook Road, there wasn't kind of any sort of saying goodbye to the house, because Terry Smith was in there carving something into the wall. He was stripping off the plaster off the wall, and so there was this kind of late sort of flowering use of the property.
So were there like tree houses down Philibert Road then?
Yeah, there was a few. There was a few people in the trees, and there was kind of towers in Claremont Road and things. And Graham Miller is I don't know if he's on your list either, but he was living there and he had a disabled son, and he allowed one of the protesters who was living in the towers, living in the trees, to sleep on his floor one night.
Yeah.
And the next morning, or it seemed like the next morning, maybe it was the day after, the police broke down his door at 6 o'clock in the morning and told him to get out with with his son and everything, no warning whatsoever. Yeah. He had to leave. And there's, I think he's still fairly traumatized by that. There's lots of people making films, John Smith, Graham, Ian Bourne, all making films about being in that area, and in the end it was pretty devastating and difficult and depressing. Mm-hmm. Everybody was sort of struggling with the loss of this place.
Do you think the people were attached, like the artists?
Yeah, I think they were. I think they were, and it was quite difficult because the most militant people were the people that were against the motorway, and so they didn't have any sort of emotional personal investment in the places at all. For them it was a kind of local but political issue, and they were kind of really aggressive and assertive, and putting roadblocks and. But the actual people that lived there and cared about it really were sort of sidelined, and so we all rather forlornly sort of put our heads down and sort of went off to the station and came back again, and it was pretty miserable. It was a pretty miserable time, actually, in lots of ways. It had been incredibly exciting, because it wasn't so much a sort of a community where everybody lived in each other's pocket. But it did make lots of art activities possible that wouldn't have been, no one would have been able to afforded to live that way otherwise.
Yeah, because I remember you and Cornelia and say Terry Smith and John Smith and Ian Bourne as a kind of group of people, and I always thought that you guys had been there a little bit longer than say I'd been there, and you seemed to be getting lots of work done. And do you think sort of maybe being together was like a catalyst as well for generation of ideas, the opportunity of maybe being in a place where you can engage with artists so readily?
I don't think we were down, we weren't down the pub really discussing, having debates about work. We just all took it for granted that we were all artists, I think. And that's what we cared about, and that's what we thought about, and it was a sort of model for a way of kind of living, really. But as I say, I didn't really care about anything else. I was only focused on the work. Really. So that's really that's why I was doing so much of it. It's sad that we didn't make more of it, that we weren't more of a kind of a cohesive group of people. But I suppose we sort of supported each other in just being a kind of a strange group of sort of eclectic people doing this thing. It became normal that that's what you did. So it was supportive in that way, I suppose.
Yeah. Do you miss that environment in any way now that you live here, for example? Are there bits that you miss or bits that you're relieved to have gone, or looking back, sort of?
Well, I don't think if I hadn't lived like that, I don't know how I would have survived doing what I do. You know, I just about make money now doing what I do. But it's still sort of break even, really, stuff. But it's on a slightly higher level.
Mm. How did you survive day to day there? Like, what did you do for a living?
Well, I was doing part-time teaching. I did quite a lot of part-time teaching, and I was doing regular teaching at Goldsmiths. I was sort of teaching from about 1988.
Okay.
And I started off doing one day a week. I only wanted to do one day a week because I was so focused on my own work. I didn't want that to interfere. And then I was sort of worried that I was offered 2 days a week and thought that was starting to kind of encroach, you know.
Because it's usually the other way around. That's why I'm laughing, because most people think, you know, I've only got one day a week, so I really want to, and then that means that I've got enough to live on, you know.
No, I really didn't. I really didn't want a job. But in the end, it sort of backfired, really, because I ended up taking on other jobs. You know, you don't get asked to do a day here and a day there, and you know, and although I'd refused to have a proper job, or you know, a sort of more kind of senior job, I ended up working harder than I probably would have done if I had got a senior job by doing all these bits. You know, I didn't feel that I could turn anything down, and because it was just one-off things, it wasn't a long-term commitment, it wasn't a regular commitment. I felt I could do it, but actually they kept coming. And you know, quite often that sort of getting the balance right between working and teaching was has always been tricky, I think, really.